the U.S. House passes much-needed aid for Ukraine.
I think this is an important moment, an important opportunity.
With the measure now moving to the U.S. Senate, what's the reaction in Kyiv?
Definitely, it was an extremely positive vibe.
Plus, coordinating efforts to prosecute alleged war crimes.
There will be additional evidence that will emerge, 5 years from now, 10 years from now.
And a popular video game gets a makeover. Today is Monday, April 22nd. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller in for Lori London. On Saturday, U.S. lawmakers in the House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed a $95 billion foreign aid bill. The measure now heads to the U.S. Senate, which is expected to take up the vote early this week. And to bring us up to speed, we hear first from VOA's Arash Arabasadi.
Funding for Ukraine's war against invading Russia. Israel's war on Hamas in Palestinian territories, and support for Taiwan's military against a possible attack from China. The United States House of Representatives overwhelmingly voted to provide aid in surprisingly bipartisan fashion for a Congress that's been bitterly divided along party lines. The vote was Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson's first major test leading his party's razor-thin majority.
I've said it very simply, I'll say it once again, it's an old military adage, but we would rather send bullets to the conflict overseas than our own boys, our troops. And I think this is an important moment, an important opportunity to make that decision. We allowed the House to do that, and I expect the Senate will make the same decision.
Johnson secured the necessary votes only by reaching across the aisle for help from House Democrats. Two hard right members of Johnson's conference threatened his ouster if he followed through with the Ukraine aid vote. Johnson's allies credit his fortitude in the face of rebellion. Republican Representative Michael McCaul, speaking Sunday on ABC's This Week, as provided by the social media platform X.
I am so proud of the Speaker Mike Johnson. He went through a transformation. At the end of the day, a profile in courage is putting the nation above yourself. And that's what he did. He said at the end of the day, I'm going to be on the right side of history, irrespective of my job. And I think that was what I admired so much.
One of the biggest sticking points for many Republicans was future funding for Ukraine. That country's leadership has been pleading with Western powers for material support in its war against invading Russia since the onset in February 2022. With the House passing its foreign aid package, Ukraine's president was quick to thank lawmakers and the American people. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, speaking through an interpreter on NBC's Meet the Press, as carried on the social media platform X.
This aid will strengthen Ukraine and send the Kremlin a powerful signal that it will not be the second Afghanistan. The United States will stay with Ukraine, will protect the Ukrainians, and they will protect, they'll protect democracy.
The bill contains $60 billion in aid for Kyiv now in its third year of war with Moscow. It includes $26 billion for Israel's war effort against Hamas, as well as humanitarian aid for civilians in conflict zones like Gaza. And another $8 billion for the Indo-Pacific region, where Taiwan continues readiness exercises should China invade. The legislation now moves to the Senate, where a vote should come early this week, advancing the measure to U.S. President Joe Biden's desk for his signature. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
On Monday, Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov asserted that the United States aid package to Ukraine will not change the situation on the front lines. Now for more on the reaction from Kyiv, I'm joined by Anna Chernikova. Anna, we heard from President Zelensky, but how are other people reacting to the passage of this House bill?
Definitely, it was an extremely positive vibe when the vote passed. I can say that I think that it was probably the first time in Ukrainian history that a lot of Ukrainians were watching live the U.S. Congress session. And definitely people were extremely excited about that and really hopeful that the approval will be happening. So a lot of people in Ukraine and discussed a lot that everyone, they have fears about this, you know, talks about the future new Russian assault. There is also information about extreme shortage of ammunition at the battlefield, at the front line. So definitely this approval of this package, definitely Ukrainians feel that this package will give a lot of possibilities to Ukraine, not only to repel this future assault, but even maybe at some areas of the front line to get more success.
And really quickly, in the time that we have left, Anna, I believe the Ukrainian military has confirmed a strike in Sevastopol.
The Russian ship called the Komuna was hit, and this is Russian supply ship for the Black Sea Fleet of the Russian Federation. And Ukrainian authorities said that it's still to be clarified the amount of damage and the level of damage. But according to preliminary information, the ship is no longer operational. This is not a combat ship. However, this ship is important for Russian Black Sea Fleet. In particular, it was used to survey the place where the flagship of the Russian Black Sea Fleet Moskva sank. So basically it was quite, used quite a lot by the Russian forces. So at this point, this is what we have.
Anna Chernikova reports for VOA from Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, as always, we appreciate your time.
Thank you, Steve.
Now, while many people think that the bill's passage will get Ukraine back on track, some don't. VOA's Scott Walterman spoke with Daniel L. Davis, a senior fellow and military expert at defense priorities. He's also a retired U.S. Army lieutenant colonel who served in four combat zones, including Iraq and Afghanistan.
It doesn't matter what they get or how much they're going to get. It's not going to change the course of the war. There's going to be, in my view, a great disappointment among all these people who were flag-waving cheerleaders on the floor of the House of Representatives and all their other supporters on television networks that have been saying how important this aid is, as though that was the difference between winning and losing. It's never been between that, and this will prove that, because the fundamentals that go between why Russia's winning and Ukraine's losing is exacerbated by the lack of shells and the interceptor missiles, but it's not because of those things.
Okay, so if it's not throwing munitions at Ukraine, what is it?
Whatever is going to be in this package, and that's still the big question I have, and I've been looking and I haven't seen it so far, of exactly how many shells this is going to purchase, how many air defense systems it's going to provide. I haven't seen any of those yet, but that's going to be critical to deciding how long it can even help, because that's the message you're going to get. So, for example, that there was allegedly an imbalance along the front line of up to 1 to 5, 1 to 10 in disparity in both personnel and in artillery shells, depending on where on the front you're looking at right now. That's why they say they've needed this amount of ammunition. But here's the thing. Russia is producing somewhere, and I'm talking producing, coming off the assembly lines, around 250,000 shells per month. The West is producing cumulatively somewhere between 35 and 40,000 shells per month by the most recent estimates I could get. And that has nothing to do with this supplemental. That's just as many as we can physically crank out. Now, what apparently this supplemental is going to allow is that as soon as the president signs it, he's going to send that number of shells from our existing inventory into Ukraine. So they don't have to wait till it gets produced. They're just going to get it. But that's the big question. How many shells are we talking about? Because then you have to take that number and then divide it by, you know, the front. And then let's just say that maybe you can change the ratio from 1 to 5 to 2 to 5 or 2 to 7. You're not going to redress that total change. And one of the bigger issues on the battlefield is Russia's accelerating electronic warfare capacity. So even though Ukraine has a lot of drones, 80% of them, by one count, are getting knocked out of the sky by electronic means. Russia's producing more of that, on the other hand, which aren't being knocked down at that pace. Russia has more missiles, and that's nothing's going to reverse those imbalances. And the biggest issue, the number one issue, is manpower. It's not about machines. It's not about ammo. It's not about money. It's about manpower. They're losing more people than they gain every month. Russia, on the other hand, is adding 30 to 40,000 troops per month signing up. So they are more motivated because they see they're winning. That's the big issue that I just want to pound home, that this supplemental is not going to change anything on the battlefield. It may expand the amount of time that Ukraine has, but ultimately it won't change the outcome. It's just going to make loss more expensive.
Defense Priorities military expert Daniel L. Davies speaking with International Edition host Sky Walterman. And while Russia steps up attacks on Ukraine, coordinated efforts to investigate and prosecute war crimes committed during Moscow's invasion continue. We'll hear more as Lori London speaks with Ambassador Clint Williamson, lead advisor of the Atrocity Crimes Advisory Group for Ukraine.
We've been hearing almost from the start of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine that war crimes were being committed, stories of mass graves that we heard. Can you speak to the potential scale of Russian war crimes up to this point, and are they ongoing?
Yeah, I went out to Ukraine a week after the full-scale invasion. So I went with a small team of people at the request of the prosecutor general. We were on the ground 8 days after the invasion and started working with the Office of the Prosecutor General. I think our first meeting was on March 3rd, 2022. At that very first meeting, at that point, they had already registered around 300 war crimes cases. Now that number is over 125,000. So it is just on an enormous scale. Those numbers will come down some. I mean, there obviously will be some reporting. There will be some cases that probably shouldn't have been classified as war crimes. So there are a number of things that will bring the numbers down, but we're still talking about tens of thousands of cases that they're going to have to deal with. It's going to be impossible for the court system to deal with every single one of these. So they are going to have to prioritize cases, have to determine which ones are more serious, those that involve multiple deaths, those that are particularly heinous, those that are occurring on a large scale, things like that, that will go into this kind of triage process, for lack of a better word, and that they'll have to narrow down and then figure out which of these cases they have to pursue. But this process will go on for years and years. If you look at the domestic systems in the Balkans, places like Croatia and Bosnia, they're still dealing with war crimes cases 30 years on. And I think that's going to be the same in Ukraine.
This war is reaching a pretty critical point for Ukraine, a pretty dire situation with the vital U.S. funding having been stalled for months, and Russia seems to be taking advantage of that in recent weeks, targeting Ukrainian cities. Even this week, an 8-story apartment building in a northern Ukrainian city hit, apparently a hospital. And also we're hearing, or we're seeing, what it would appear to be intentional targeting of Ukraine's energy sector. It appears to be an effort to cripple Ukraine's electrical grid. Would that constitute a war crime?
It can. And I think the way that the Russians are going about this, it does constitute a war crime. So without getting too technical, there is a concept that's referred to as dual-use targets. So these are targets that are primarily civilian in nature, but can be used for military purposes. So, for example, if you have a factory that is producing mainly civilian cars, but is also producing tanks, that would be a dual-use facility and could potentially make it a legitimate target for military attacks. So it's a question of proportionality. You have to determine what is the military uses of a certain facility, and does that justify the attacks. What we are seeing, though, I think, in Ukraine is the targeting of facilities, of a lot of different buildings and places that are almost entirely civilian in nature. And clearly the intention of the Russians here is to create deprivation in the civilian population, to make it difficult for Ukrainians to go about daily life. And the scale, the scope of these attacks over an extended period, I think argue very strongly for this being an intentional attack on a civilian facility, which war crime.
So prosecuting international war crimes, as you mentioned, takes years and years and years. The International Criminal Court in The Hague, mm-hmm. about a year ago, issued arrest warrants for Russian officials due to the forcible mm-hmm. deportation of children from Ukraine. Will part of your work be to see any of these war crimes Ukraine is trying to take on within its own justice system? Will that be any quicker? Or as you said, will it just all be mm-hmm. just years and years from now?
What I was meaning when I talked about the process going on for years, I think more in the sense of it's just going to take that long to get through these investigations, these prosecutions. There will be additional evidence that will emerge, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, that will help to identify perpetrators that may not be known right now. So cases will continue to be produced over time. The reality is that at the moment, Ukraine has very few Russian perpetrators in custody. They have some who are prisoners of war, but most of these tend to be very low level, you know, perhaps conscript soldiers, where you might have one soldier who killed one person. So it is relatively small scale crimes. Those they can prosecute and they can put people physically on trial in a court in Ukraine. Beyond that, they will be issuing indictments, arrest warrants against more senior figures. But right now, they don't have any ability to put these people on trial. So unless they are tried in absentia, Ukrainian law allows for trials in absentia, but I think they will use that only on a limited scale. Whether those people will ever be brought to trial in Ukraine physically, it's hard to say. You know, there could be a change to a more rule of law oriented government in Russia at some point. Right now, that seems unlikely, but stranger things have happened.
Clint Williamson is the lead advisor of the Atrocity Crimes Advisory Group for Ukraine, and you can hear the full conversation on this past weekend's Issues in the News, hosted by Lori London. And in just a few moments, how a video game is raising money for schools in Ukraine.
The funds will be used to restore a school in the Dnipro region destroyed by a Russian missile.
This is VOA News. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Artificial intelligence continues to play a role in modern information warfare, revolutionizing the way that data is processed, analyzed, and disseminated. As technology advances, understanding the intersection of AI and information warfare becomes increasingly crucial and safeguarding the integrity of information ecosystems. Now, to take a closer look at how the United States, China, and Russia all use AI in their respective information warfare operations, I caught up with Augusta University professors Lance Hunt and Craig Albert, two of the authors of a recent study on this topic, which was published in Defense and Security Analysis. So, Lance Hunter, I'm going to begin with you since you are the lead author on this paper. Broadly speaking, what kinds of artificial intelligence tools are being employed by the United States, Russia, and China as part of their information warfare campaigns?
Yeah, so there are a number. When we're thinking of Russia and China, in large measure, they're using artificial intelligence in their information warfare or influence operations offensively to a decent degree, meaning you try to target individuals and groups in different countries, a lot of times Western democracies, to try to influence public opinion. And this can be done in a lot of instances through specific algorithms on social media or other online platforms that are meant to influence individuals' opinions regarding Russia, China, or in some instances to try to increase any type of political division or polarization within countries so both Russia and China can influence their world standing or try to influence certain issues. So artificial intelligence can be used through social media platforms. It can be used in different types of online platforms. platforms to try to manipulate opinion. And algorithms are a key component of that at times, and artificial intelligence can very much be used within those algorithms.
And Craig Albert, you know, one of the things that struck me as I read through the paper was that it was mentioned that artificial intelligence can be not only a force multiplier, but also an alternative to kinetic attacks. How exactly is that possible?
So the one way is much of the literature, and actually, you know, the US DOD thought it would initially be used as a force multiplier. That means it's not a weapon of war itself or a complete separate domain of war, but it's used in separate domains of war to enhance US or, depending on which nation state we're talking about, their military capabilities in an already confined space. So if you think about the cyber domain, AI can help as a multiplier in that space. But what we're actually finding is that it might be, you know, a weapon or a tool of itself just to be offensive or defensive in its own right, rather than just being a force multiplier. And we're really seeing this through cyber capabilities as well, where the U.S. can defensively, for instance, use AI to detect any malicious or potentially malicious cyber weapons that might be hiding in U.S. infrastructure. AI has the capability to sift through that data much more efficiently than, say, you know, a few individuals working at, for instance, U.S. Army Cyber Command. So it now becomes like a tool and a weapon of itself. Even though it exists in other domains, it's really acting on itself. So it can be a force multiplier. Let's say that it can operate with autonomous vehicles, autonomous warfighting vehicles, for instance, and really help push those out in a timely fashion. Or it exists by itself, for instance, on social media or through social media algorithms, as Dr. Hunter was speaking of. It can really push the amount of messages, the type of messages, and who the target of those messages is, really becoming a weapon in its own right.
Augusta University professors Lance Hunt and Craig Albert, and we'll have the rest of that conversation on Tuesday's Flashpoint Global Crises. And finally, there's a Ukrainian version of the famous video game Minecraft. The new game, called Mine Salt, is based on Ukraine's famous Soledar salt mines. Anna Kosachenko brings us that story to round us out.
The Soledar salt mines in Ukraine once attracted tourists who could spend hours exploring the vast underground caverns. That was until the war. The mine shut down in early 2023, but United24, the official fundraising platform of Ukraine, wanted people to continue to explore their beauty and history.
When Russia occupied Soledar in February 2023, we immediately started thinking about projects that can tell the city's story and remind the world about our unique salt mines, about Ukraine fighting for each of its cities.
Thanks to the effort, the salt mines are virtually accessible to Minecraft players. This spin-off includes 16 locations and offers a quiz that players can complete for a chance to win prizes, explains Gris.
The Mine Salt world created in Minecraft is dedicated to Soledar. To win, you need to listen carefully to the stories you hear during your online journey. By the end, you need to collect crystals.
Mine Salt ambassadors help players throughout the game. Among them are celebrities like Canadian TV star of Ukrainian origin Catherine Winnick, Virgin Group founder Richard Branson, Nobel Prize winner Paul Nurse, actor Misha Collins, boxer Alexander Usyk, football player Alexander Zinchenko, Ukrainian actress Ivana Sarno, and former NASA astronaut Scott Kelly.
There's a lot of hidden places in the salt mines, right? And you'd be in there looking for crystals, right? And the kids would learn the history of Soledar and its mines.
Kelly has been engaged with the effort to help Ukraine for almost 2 years. He visited the Ahmadi Children's Hospital in Kyiv. He has also pledged over $500,000 he received from the sale of his NFT collection called Dreams Out of This World.
I said it was the fifth most meaningful trip I've ever taken, but that's only because I've flown in space 4 times.
To recreate the mines in the game, developers spoke to people like Stepan Vandrievsky, who worked for Artem Seal, the company that ran the mine.
There were tours for tourists through the mines. They accommodated soccer matches and inflation of a hot air balloon, an event included in the Guinness Book of Records.
When the game developers approached him, he saw it as a unique opportunity to show his former workplace to his six-year-old daughter.
When Ukraine is liberated from these terrorists, we will return because it's our home.
Minesil players can use a special QR code to send money to Ukrainian schools. United 24 coordinators say over 100,000 was raised in the week after the game's release. The funds will be used to restore a school in the Dnipro region destroyed by Russian missile. Anna Kostyuchenko for VOA News, Kyiv, Ukraine.
And that's all the time we have for this week. On behalf of everyone at VOA, I'd like to thank you for joining us. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller.